Welcome to the Seven Figure Leaders podcast. This podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners, and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. And there you'll find the link to apply.
Welcome. And today we've got Callum Woodcock from WineFi. Welcome, Callum.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So we were just having a very interesting conversation before we pressed record, and you were telling me all about the background of WineFi and how you got started and kind of where you're at now. So why didn't you share that with anyone who's listening?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame it's the second time you've heard that, Tom. Sorry, Slack. So I guess the basic idea for WineFi came from the recognition that fine wine has many very interesting characteristics as an asset class. So historically, it's behaved or performed a lot like the equity indices have, at times outperforming various different equity indices, especially on a regional level. It displays a very low correlation to traditional asset classes, so bonds, equities, commodities, which make it an interesting diversifier. It's highly tax efficient. It's capital gains tax exempt in many circumstances in the UK. And I think more than anything else, it's also interesting. You know, it's the fun bit of your portfolio in the way that perhaps your S&P 500 index fund isn't. And as a result, I think it's quite an attractive investment for many people. The issue is twofold. So first of all, access to fine wine as an asset class has historically been very limited. You know, you really need to have a relationship with a wine merchant or a wine investment company, which of course not everyone does. So you really have to be part of that world. And then of course, it's the cost of actually building a diversified portfolio. So anywhere from 25 to 50 to 100K plus, really to build any semblance of a diversified wine portfolio. And then the final thing is around the actual wines that people are selecting for that particular portfolio. So the typical way that a wine business would analyze the investability or not of a wine would be to compare price to critic scores, which is a very, very basic way of detecting the investability or otherwise of a wine. And so really WineFi exists, one, to lower the cost of entry. So at the moment, it's as little as £3,000. You can gain exposure to a diversified collection of fine wine that you co-own with other investors via a wine investment syndicate. But it's also about bringing quantitative analysis to a market that over the last 25 years has thrown up a lot of interesting data, you know, real-time trading data, but hasn't really been analyzed in this way before. And if I'm honest, that's the part of the business that increasingly excites me, because we can now see the value of that quantitative analysis filtering through to how our syndicates are performing. So it's, we like to say internally, we're kind of building Moneyball for wine, which is quite a fun place to be, actually.
Wow, that's really interesting. And so who's in charge of the crunching the data and the analytical side? Is that you?
No. Luckily for our investors, not myself. So we have a two-man data team. So we have our head of data, Aaron Amelie Daniel, who built the model really from the ground up. He's recently been joined by Raf van den Bosch, who has a PhD in theoretical nuclear physics. And we sort of joke on LinkedIn occasionally that we can probably say with a relatively high degree of certainty that we're the only wine investment platform that has a nuclear physicist on the table. But they've done a fantastic job building something, you know, that appears to be truly outperforming the markets.
Wow, well, that's really, really interesting. So going back a few years, what's the journey? In fact, before we do that, what is the actual model? So how do you make money?
Yeah, sure. So again, this aligns with a problem that we want to solve within fine wine. So at the moment, we take a one-off administrative fee. There are regulatory reasons why it has to be a one-off fee rather than a recurring one. But we don't take any undisclosed markup on the wine itself. So a traditional wine merchant would make money buying wine from producers or at wholesale and then marking them to market price and then taking that as their margin. There's nothing wrong with that if the person that you're selling to is buying to collect or to drink. The conflict appears when someone is specifically trying to invest. Because if you're a stockholding merchant, you are therefore clearly incentivized not to source the best wines that are available on the market, but specifically to sell them what you have in stock.
Yeah.
And so we've structured the model whereby our only fee is that transparent, the only fee that we have is that upfront fee that covers storage and insurance for 5 years. That's 12.5%, so broadly equivalent to 2.5% per year over that 5 year hold. If the wines are held for longer than 5 years, then we would simply take the cost of storing and insuring the wines at cost from the eventual sales price of the wine. So we have a very, very transparent model that aligns our interests with those of our clients. And beyond that, it actually really works for us because we have no massive upfront capital requirements. We don't have to go out and buy stock. So actually we can run a very lean business. You know, our core fixed costs other than, you know, like the cloud and running our tech platform really are just people. And that means that we can run a very lean business. You know, there's seven of us at the moment. I don't think the team will ever be bigger than sort of 15, 16. And that's really by design. You know, we're trying to build something that resembles in some ways a hedge fund rather than, you know, a large wine merchant or a traditional asset manager.
Absolutely. So do you also take a performance fee or anything on the back end?
We don't. It's something that we may look to explore at some point in time. Interestingly, a lot of people are more comfortable with the idea that we would, but we didn't build it into the kind of version one of the model that we're running at the moment with our syndicates. But for private portfolios, which are owned by individuals, you know, we would happily change our structure in order to include a performance fee to fully align our interests. But ultimately, 30% of our revenue comes from people reinvesting. If we do a bad job for them, they simply aren't going to reinvest. So it is still very much in our interest to ensure that our portfolios outperform.
Yeah. And so from that 12%, so that 12% is the only money you collect for 5 years. You can, from that 12%, that more than covers your operation and gives you enough.
12.5%, but yes, it does. So to give you an idea, storage and insurance is like less than 1% of that fee. And that really, other than salaries, is our only fixed cost.
I see. So diving into the journey that you've been on, so we touched on this before we press live.
Yeah.
Run me through kind of where the idea came from and then how you went about raising the money and how you just got started.
Yeah, sure. So I started my career in asset management. So I was on the Fidelity grad scheme and then moved across to JP Morgan. At the same time, my now wife, then girlfriend's family were very deep in the wine trade. Her dad ran an import-export business. Which was later sold, but he was a wine collector himself. And so it didn't take me too long to combine that kind of investment interest with an interest in wine as a consumable. And when I found out about wine's characteristics as an investment, you know, it was so esoteric. It was nothing that we would have touched at JP Morgan.
Yeah.
I just thought, this is fascinating. How can I start investing in this, basically? I think I had 10 grand or something to invest at the time. And I couldn't imagine spending that much money on wine to drink. And so I made it very clear to the investment house that I was speaking to, the wine investment manager that I was speaking to, that it was solely for investment purposes. And it just struck me that there was a level of unprofessionalism that you would never get from a regulated asset manager, you know, high pressure sales tactics, a real lack of transparency as to why the wines that were supposedly being allocated to my portfolio were the right ones. And then when you go to a wine merchant, as I said, you know, they're set up really to facilitate drinking and collecting rather than investing for the most part. And so there just seemed not to be a solution for someone like me. So after spending a few years as commercial director of a early stage startup, you know, leading their go-to-market, figuring out product market fit, and then eventually growing them, we made the decision to really go full-time on what we then termed Winify to try and solve some of these issues. So we, the CEO of the previous business I was at, a legal tech company called Nomio, very kindly allowed me to sort of fundraise for Winify during my notice period at that particular company. And really, you know, we started with no network in the kind of angel investment world. But I think because anything to do with fine wine captures people's imagination, word got around quite quickly. SFC Capital, so UK's leading SAIS fund, led our seed round, and then our pre-seed round, and then a major fine wine holdco called Coterie participated in that round as well. And they had the effect of really opening doors within the wine trade for a business that had been founded to solve the problems in that particular field, but was not from that particular field. And that's been an absolutely incredible partner to have throughout this journey. And then we proved out product market fit, scaled the business to a certain degree. So about $1.5 million in revenue, raised a seed round. And yeah, we're now looking to figure out our unit economics and continue our growth from here.
So diving into that a bit more, what was that first step? So you got your check, the money that you raised, and then how did you actually go about getting your first clients and making the hires?
Yeah, sure. So I'm quite gung-ho in terms of the sales element was, I kind of felt at the time, almost the only part of the business that I could do, given, you know, we're having our data model built out, we're having our tech platform built out. I'm not a dev, I'm not a data scientist. And what was quite interesting is the first day that I went full-time on Winify, so the 1st of October 2023, and we posted on LinkedIn, we had a ton of inbound interest straight away. We began building portfolios. It was prior to us actually having our syndicate structure in place, so just one-to-one portfolios using our data model for these people that had signed up. And actually, it was amazing having that initial traction, because it gets you to product market fit very, very quickly in a way that I hadn't experienced at a previous SaaS business, where it's all about tailoring the features to the use case that your client wants. And ultimately, people wanted to be able to invest in wine with confidence that the wines had been selected based on their potential to outperform the market, and ideally at a fraction of the cost of traditional solutions. And when we could show that we could do all of that, we immediately attracted kind of a base layer of supporters that were really interested in what we were doing. So that was great. But then the real unlock came when we released our first investment syndicate. So that allows multiple investors to co-own a collection of fine wine. And that is something that, to our knowledge, hadn't been done before. You know, it's structured in the same way as a property syndicate, for example. It's not a fund. It's not a collective investment scheme. It's a structure that allows investors to retain day-to-day control of the assets and direct ownership of the underlying wines. And what that allowed us to do was work with distribution partners to access their audiences. So we would know if you had an audience of people interested in alternative investments or into wine or collectibles or, you know, various other subcategories, then there's a chance you might be interested in what Winify was doing. And that really proved to be true. And I think those partnerships and those relationships that we've built with kind of intermediaries, almost, you know, it's like a B2B2C approach, really been instrumental in our growth. And because we've got a product where people are able to self-serve, I don't think any traditional business, you know, traditional wine investment business where you're selling one-to-one could actually pursue the same strategy. So we're hiring a head of partnerships at the moment to lead that, because up till, you know, to date, that's basically just been me. Yeah. And I'm really excited, because I think that there's a lot more that we could get from that channel. And it's great, because once you show that you can work well with a third party and that you can make them money through, you know, commission or whatever it might be, then they want to work with you again and again. So I'm really excited about that channel, because I don't feel like it's been done in quite the right way in the space today.
Wow, that's really impressive that you saw that first bit of growth so quickly. And you said from pretty much, was it literally one LinkedIn post, or did you do multiple?
Well, once that first one worked, I then started posting like every day, much to the chagrin of my like friendship group and anyone that was connected with me on LinkedIn. And it's something we still do. You know, there was a stage where we were getting 90% of our traffic from LinkedIn. That's now about 50%, but only because we've opened up other channels. You know, we still post every day. The reach that you're able to get essentially for free is just extraordinary. You know,
you've got to have some posts, though. You've got to have posts people are interested in, otherwise they just flop.
Yeah, that's true. I've had a fair few flop as well. I'm ashamed to say. It's interesting. There's some that fly and you're not really sure why they've taken off. But, you know, we measure our weekly impressions by Winify employee. And I typically do 30,000 to 60,000 from 20,000 followers. And when I look at that compared to what we'd be spending for that same number of impressions via ads, you know, LinkedIn does seem like a no-brainer. I read a great post talking about like the bridge of cringe. Have you heard of this concept?
Yeah, I actually did a post on that. Like,
was it you that I saw
it in my post? I wonder if it was my post. Yeah, it was an image that showed it literally a bridge of like getting over the cringiness to.
Yeah, well, it must be well. In that case, follow Tom Griffiths.
And there's someone else posting about it.
But I loved that concept because I thought that is so true. You know, if you know, you're too embarrassed to put yourself out there, then you miss the opportunity to utilize a channel like LinkedIn. And you know, it does take like a lot of guts. Like I remember now I just write a post, I won't even think about it. But for the first like 4 or 5 months, I was like, oh, I hate this. And it also didn't help that like my friends would be texting me on WhatsApp going like, oh, nice thought leadership today, like a really sarcastic way. But once you get used to it, then it just becomes like a thing you do as opposed to something new and outlandish.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So for me, that's funny because it must have been my post that you read.
Yeah, sure it was.
But yeah, other than you have to put yourself out there. Otherwise, you just stay silent and you rely on your network, which in most cases isn't big enough to
get
business off the ground. So you talked about getting you from the level you're at now up to that kind of 30 million mark, getting unit economics right. So what do you need to do to get up to that level and what? You don't have to share the unit economics exactly, but what are you kind of working out in order to get there?
Yeah, sure. So we are a low margin business or a very high margin business, depending on how you're counting it. But you know, if we say 12.5%, you do have to be strategic in terms of the channels you utilize in order to get to an attractive LTV to CAC, so lifetime value to customer acquisition cost, which for venture business, kind of the base level is you really want a 3-to-1, as I'm sure you know. So a client that you onboard is worth to you 3 times more than the cost of acquiring that customer.
Yeah.
And we have been looking at various different channels that would allow us to facilitate that. The most obvious one, because it's the easiest way of measuring CAC, is through performance marketing. And we have this hypothesis whereby we've noticed if people sign up to our newsletter and they stay on that newsletter for 3 months, they're 70% more likely to invest in someone that's just come to the platform, logged in cold, because they feel like they've got to know us. So we've basically run the numbers and said, well, if we can get to a cost per lead of less than £10 for someone signing up to the newsletter, then we have a very attractive LTV to CAC. At the moment, we're at about £18, but it has been as high as, you know, 80, 90, 100 quid when we were experimenting with that channel. So we're trying lots of side experiments like that. But I think the one that has worked for us that I've touched on so far is those distribution partnerships. And the customer acquisition cost there is effectively my salary alone. And that's a pretty good place to be. And it will be, you know, when we hire a head of partnerships, it will be their salary as the acquisition, customer acquisition cost there. And that allows us to scale profitably and by taking on a very small degree of risk, because, and same with the partner, you know, if you're saying, okay, we'll do a fee split with you, then they get paid if it works. We only have to pay if it works, and both sides are happy. And it's a very low friction way of doing business. So that's another area that we're really interested in. But I'm a big believer in sort of one channel, one ICP, one offer until you're at a million or so a month. And so our plan is to really sort of lean heavily into the distribution partnerships moving forwards for the next year, 18 months, just because I think that, as I said, we're uniquely placed to be able to leverage them because of the co-investment element of our product. And it's, I think it's a really way of just really easy way of growing the audience. You know, they've already built their audience. We know that we're a volume business. You know, our revenue is reoccurring in that people reinvest, but it's not recurring. Exactly. And so therefore we need to continue getting in front of more and more people. And we've barely scratched the surface so far. So I'm very excited to look to scale that channel.
Well, that's very exciting. And so who is your ICP, just to be clear?
Sure.
Invest in wine, or someone who wants to drink wine and invest a bit on the side, or?
Yeah. So I'm sad to say that I actually disproved my original hypothesis for the company during our go-to-market process. So my original theory was that there was a large untapped group of individuals who would be interested in fine wine predominantly for its characteristics as an asset class. Whilst there are undoubtedly some, you know, you have some investors who are just like, I want to invest in something completely uncorrelated and that is tax efficient. I would say the vast majority, especially our largest investors, are interested in wine to some degree. You know, they might balk at the idea of spending tens of thousands of pounds on a portfolio, you know, that they were planning on drinking, a collection that they were planning on drinking, but they understand wine. They have seen, perhaps they've got a cellar elsewhere, and they've seen wines within that cellar appreciate, and they've got an understanding of the space. And I think those are the ones who are really the sweet spot for us. And they could be high net worth, so, you know, established wealthy people, or they could be what we've termed Henrys, so high earners, not rich yet. So, you know, consultants, lawyers, investors in their 30s or 40s, who are still on that upward career trajectory, and who want to be investing in some interesting stuff. And it's very interesting. We ran an exercise recently, and we basically found that our brand, overwhelmingly the highest number of individual investors is between the 30 to 39 demographic, and about 50% of our revenue comes from 30 to 49 year olds. The other 50% comes from a much smaller number of 50 to 59 year olds.
Right.
So it straddles basically millennials and Gen X. And I'm sure Gen Z will come through. It's just Gen Z are, you know, at the moment, mostly too young to have capital that they're willing to invest in something as esoteric as wine, which is very understandable.
Yeah. And for everyone who's interested, do they jump on a call with you and have a one-on-one conversation, or how does that work?
So they're welcome to. So typically someone would sign up to the site. They would get an email offering them to book a call. About half people take us up on it. About half don't. One of our largest investors actually has never spoken to us. That's just entirely self-served. And, you know, we've obviously reached out a number of times. We have heard back from them, you know, but he's like, no, don't worry about it. and that's absolutely him. But for something like this, especially in an unregulated space, and especially in a space where there have been some bad or at least inept actors in the past, I think having that offer is important, because, you know, I find if I'm investing in something or even just a partnership, you know, it's quite good to be able to understand who you're dealing with. And, you know, it's a horrible phrase, but kind of see the whites of their eyes a little bit. And I think when you realize that someone is sincere and they're doing things in the right way, and you get the opportunity to ask, you know, certainly difficult questions, it gives you more confidence in what you're investing in. So,
yeah.
Yeah, we've made it self-service because obviously that's where the scale comes from. You know, it wouldn't be great for us to have an onboarding call with every single client that signs up. But we don't want to take away that opportunity. So we've got, you know, a phone number on our website that anyone can call. So we're sort of hybrid. We're sort of, I would say, low touch rather than no touch.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So we'll make it very easy for anyone who's interested in having a chat with you to get in touch. We'll put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. Anything else that you want to share? Anyone that you might be looking to get in touch with, or that you want to?
Sure. I mean, we're always interested in speaking to partners who have an audience of individuals that might be interested in investing in something like fine wine. But really, you know, I'm very happy to talk to anyone that wants to find out more about the business. So my personal email is Callum, C-A-L-L-U-M @winefi.co. So please do feel free to reach out. Tom, yeah, please feel free to add my LinkedIn profile, but apologies in advance for anyone that is seeing my daily posts on LinkedIn.
I'm sure they like them. but Callum, pleasure to have you on as a guest. Thanks very much. I'm wishing you all the best with WineFi.
Thanks. Thanks. Great to see you, Tom.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co, and click podcast. On that page, you'll find the link to apply.